Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, stay ahead with stories that really count. Coming up on the program, the presidency on the expulsion of South Africa's ambassador to Washington, the fight between Starlink and space sale. Environmental groups hit out at the budget, questioning government's commitment to climate change action. And post-budget 2025, financial pressure mounting for all of us, why cash flow continues to kill small business. It's Monday, the 17th of March. As you well know, South Africa's ambassador to the United States, Ibrahim Rasool, has been expelled. He was given 72 hours to leave the country. The South African government has confirmed that it's making urgent arrangements for his return. To help us understand the diplomatic implications of this extraordinary development, speaking for the presidency, Vincent Magwenya. Vincent, a very warm welcome. Presidency saying at the weekend that it's confident all of this can be mended. Right now, how would you describe Pretoria's relations with Washington?
Certainly and admittedly, we are in a bit of a bumpy patch. The situation is difficult. Notwithstanding those difficulties, we are not dissuaded at all with respect to focusing on the positives and the opportunities that could arise when we reset this relationship, which is something we are hard at work in ensuring that we do.
So what are the positives and what work are you doing? How are you going to fix this?
So there are engagements that are currently taking place at various levels with the Trump administration. Ambassador Rasool was making some headway also in that regard. We want to focus more on areas where we can align or we already aligned with the Trump administration. You will know that there are institutional arrangements between ourselves and the United States that predate this administration, and they're longstanding. We want to maintain those. There are also opportunities with respect to growing and expanding our trade relationship, whether within AGOA or outside of AGOA. And there are other areas where we do find each other with the U.S. For example, we share President Trump's view and determination to see the end of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. We can work together with respect to facilitating that peace process and sharing our experiences in terms of resolving what seems like intractable conflicts. And so there are a number of positives, areas of cooperation in energy that we can explore with the Trump administration with respect to trade. And that is what's making us excited at the opportunity to reset this relationship, notwithstanding the current difficulties.
But you will concede that Ambassador Rasool overreached in his comments at the Mapungubwe Institute webinar. Does the presidency believe that the statements that he made were appropriate for a diplomat?
Ambassador Rasool is an experienced diplomat. This was his second tour to the United States. He will certainly, in our view, reflect on his experience there. He will reflect on the incident that you referenced that led to his expulsion. For us, certainly, there are lessons to be drawn from this, and we will reflect on those lessons.
What are those lessons?
Well, the lessons, for example, are, you know, what kind of support and guidance do we continuously provide to diplomats with respect to prevailing conditions on the ground where they're operating? Normally, one assumes, Jeremy, that our senior diplomats understand the parameters of diplomacy when engaging with the host country or engaging on matters related to the host country. And so going forward, DIRCO and ourselves will ensure that there is sufficient support and the understanding of those parameters is deeply embedded amongst our diplomats.
It sounds to me as if you're saying Ambassador Rasool didn't understand what those parameters were.
Well, we certainly think he did. He did. That's why I'm measured, Jeremy, deliberately so, by saying he will reflect. That's our belief, that he will reflect on this particular incident. He will reflect on his time in Washington, so as we will do, and draw lessons from the experience.
Does he still have a job?
Well, DIRCO will have to iron out those details with him. He had a contract, or he has a contract, and that contract was a mandate over representing South Africa and the president in the United States. DIRCO will have to then look at its processes with respect to how it then reconciles the premature end of his time in the U.S. with his contract.
You will concede as well that some diplomatic damage has been done. It's a little more than just a bumpy relationship, as you described to me a little earlier.
Well, I mean, this incident is sort of foregrounded with what you will refer as diplomatic tensions that have been there for quite some time, of not our own doing in this regard, where we have been recipients of various messages via social media channels, which is, you know, outside of the established diplomatic protocols in this regard. And so one can concede that the ground was certainly not fertile for the kind of comments that were made, because already there were issues that were bubbling on the surface that needed to be addressed. And we were in the process of looking at how do we substantively research the relationship. The president was not particularly keen to dispatch a delegation that will go to the U.S. to explain ourselves over matters we believe are well known and are well understood. However, he remains interested in leading the formulation of a trade deal proposal and engaging with the U.S. substantively over that trade deal proposal that would be mutually beneficial.
Is the presidency prepared to concede that the real problem is Pretoria's close relationship with Tehran, and that is causing the annoyance, the anger from Washington itself? If that's the case, would that relationship in any way be relooked at?
No, Jeremy, I think that is an oversimplification of rather slightly complex matters, because what we have seen in various posts and other information is that the issue is not only with Iran, which, by the way, that relationship has unfortunately been a lot more exaggerated than what it is. Russia at some point was added in the mix, and that dynamic has changed because we've seen the Trump administration gravitating closer towards Russia than to Ukraine. Whilst we've maintained our non-aligned status, we've also seen issues being expressed with respect to the ICJ case that we've instituted against Israel, where we've argued that that is a peaceful response utilizing established international legal instrument to deal with that conflict and what is of concern to us and many other countries that have joined that case. And so it will be too simplistic to locate the issues over one country where there's no evidence that backs up those concerns in terms of our diplomatic relationship with Tehran posing any significant threat to the U.S. or to the U.S.'s national interest.
Vincent Magwenya, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, China's space sail, it's been dubbed the Chinese Starlink, I read is making significant strides by launching in over 30 countries and potentially South Africa. The development comes as Elon Musk's Starlink faces regulatory challenges in this country, primarily due to the country's black economic empowerment laws, which, as you know, require foreign-owned telecom companies to have at least 30% black South African ownership. So what's the landscape look like? I'm in conversation now with tech commentator Toby Shapshak, editor-in-chief of Stuff Studios. Toby, welcome to you. Very briefly, what exactly is SpaceSail?
Well, it's hi, Jeremy, first. And it seems to be a similar kind of service to Starlink, which is Elon Musk's satellite service. These are very low orbiting satellites that point down to Earth and give us an internet signal. Of course, this is very science fiction and it is very remarkable. And it's what's enabled, for instance, the Ukrainian military to continue functioning after Russia, during the invasion of Ukraine, took out all of their ground-based cellular communications. So it's proved to be a really remarkable form of communication, but also essential in preserving a democracy like Ukraine's, for instance.
Toby, I mentioned at the beginning an aggressive expansion worldwide. So inevitably, this competitive landscape of satellite internet services is evolving globally, and inevitably, Africa, the continent, is going to reap some sort of benefit, no doubt.
I think it will, Jeremy, because of the size of our continent and the scarcity of telecommunications infrastructure in general, especially high-speed internet access. This is just a godsend. It's such a win for us. If there are two companies competing for greater market share, we can only be the ultimate benefactors of it. So it's very good for us. It's you know, I've heard prices as low as $350 to install a Starlink terminal and $30 a month to run it. I mean, that's a game changer. That's cheap enough. You know, $350 is a chunk of change, but $30, you know, for a small business or a home, you know, to run, that's viable, and that's decent quality, fast internet infrastructure, Jeremy. That's a game changer.
But Toby, we're not there yet. Given Starlink's regulatory hurdles that I mentioned at the start of this conversation due to BEE requirements, inevitably SpaceSail is going to face similar challenges, or might they navigate these regulations, do you think, more effectively?
It's hard to say, Jeremy. On the face of it, you want to say that they're likely to face the same challenges. But then again, they're going to be less obstreperous than Elon Musk has been. And he's been the purveyor of some terrible misinformation. Of course, a lot of very specifically South African misinformation recently. You know, I quote something like, I can't launch Starlink in South Africa, quote unquote, because I'm not black. You know, that kind of stuff just doesn't work. And it's factually untrue. And I find it deeply problematic that someone who prides himself on rationality and his love of science would resort to such baseless untruths when it's very damaging to our country, isn't it?
Toby, let's look at risk if SpaceSail does come into South Africa. There's been talk of potential cybersecurity implications if a Chinese state-backed company becomes a major internet service provider.
Yes, doesn't fill you with a lot of confidence, does it, Jeremy? It's kind of like the apartheid censors reading over your shoulder about everything. China is, after all, the country that has perfected the great firewall of China, that it's the way it controls internet access into a country of, you know, over a billion people is quite extraordinary. But it's found the technical wherewithal and way to do it, and it does do that. If that was the service provider for internet in Africa, that would have a massive implication for free speech, free access to information. You know, if you've got a whole bunch of democratic activists who only have internet access through Starlink and they want to look up what happened in Tiananmen Square, and a Chinese-owned service just won't allow you to do that. In the same way, DeepSeek won't allow you to go to search or use its Gen AI capabilities to write anything about Tiananmen Square, that's problematic, Jeremy, and that should worry us all.
Toby, could you give me a sense of what the landscape might look like in the future? So let's assume that SpaceSail in one way or another does come into the market. How does it impact, one, existing internet service providers? And give me a sense of what connectivity would look like should this happen?
It's an interesting thing, Jeremy, because people have been looking at Starlink for quite a while to work out how big its market is, what's its market share, how much it's going to make, what's worth, what's its business worth, and they haven't really gotten a lot of figures. And it seems like Starlink's kind of hit a plateau. I can't remember how many the users it had, but it seems to have kind of hit a bit of a plateau because the use case is really limited, isn't it? If you're a mine in a remote place of Africa, you've probably already got some kind of Intelsat or one of the European satellite providers internet access via that. There's quite a lot of these service providers, so it's not really for an urban environment. It's very much for a rural environment. How many people are really going to use this? You could use it on a plane while you're flying. You could use it on a yacht or a big cruise ship while you're cruising. That's not a massive market. There's not tens and tens of millions of people who need to use it for that. So as much as it's very exciting as a use case and that more of us would be able to get online in more remote places, it's not entirely sure what the business case for it is. And if you don't have a good business case, as we know, there isn't much sustainability in it.
And Toby, just finally, and test my thinking here, we know that China is making significant investments in African infrastructure more broadly. Do you think space sales expansion is part of a broader strategy to increase influence on the continent, or am I being a little cynical?
I'm not sure you are, Jeremy, and I think you could probably make a case that it is a kind of intergalactic continuation of China's Belt and Road policy, that they've built infrastructure for people, railways, ports, etc. Now they're building internet infrastructure. You could read it like that, and I don't think it would be a bad interpretation or a mistaken interpretation. But it is, once again, it comes with conditions, and that's unfortunate.
And that's where I'm going to leave it. Tech commentator Toby Shapshak, editor-in-chief of Stuff Studios, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, I want to stay with the budget aftermath, and the speech has sparked strong reactions from eco-justice organizations, some arguing that it fell short in addressing South Africa's deepening energy and climate crisis. Some critics pointing to a lack of funding for climate adaptation, continued support for fossil fuel projects, as well as the controversial increase in VAT, which they suggest will worsen energy poverty in South Africa. So let's discuss these concerns and what they mean for South Africa's transition to a greener, more sustainable future. I'm joined by Thabo Sebeko, who is Program Manager at Earth Life Africa here in Johannesburg. So first of all, welcome and thank you. You say this budget fails to address the climate crisis. What specifically would you like to have seen included?
Yeah, good afternoon to all the listeners. Yes, I think the budget speech was tabulated by the minister, Minister Kodungwane. To be frank and very honest, it actually reveals how reluctant South African government is to fast track the just transition to a low carbon economy. Because it shows how actually our government is basically willing to support the fossil fuel extractive project, as opposed to fast tracking the just transition. There are a lot of issues which basically were left out of the budget. To start with, the budget, no allocations at all, specifically for at least transitioning away from the current energy system that we have, system that basically uses a fossil fuel, to an alternative system like renewable energy, for an example. There isn't any allocation.
Do you think then that it's a question of competing priorities as far as government is concerned, or is there a suggestion that it has simply given up on just transition? What is Earth Life Africa's view?
Yeah, well, our view is that there's a lot of a pulling back from government, basically. We're currently sitting in a crisis, the crisis of climate catastrophic events are looming in the country, and all that is as a result of the current energy system which is basically, you know, as a result of the, you know, extractive projects, which constitutes pollution. Climate change is basically a reality now, you know, and the causes of climate change is basically, it comes as a result of extractive projects, such as coal mines, coal fertilization.
So what do you believe the consequences short to medium term are going to be, as you suggest government is now pulling back?
Well, the consequences would be that we might actually be facing even more climate catastrophic events that we are unable to control. You know, the worst part of the all is that there isn't any allocation of a budget to local municipalities whom are actually the first point of contact for local communities. You know, the turnaround response of municipalities when it comes to climate disasters is poor at the moment. So municipalities don't have any budget for, you know, to attend to any climate catastrophic events. The turnaround response is quite down, you know. So it's very disappointing not to see any budget allocations, especially for local municipalities to, you know, to kind of improve on their, you know, climate turnaround response.
Having said that, though, the minister did announce municipal disaster funding, but there were no clear guidelines on access or allocation. What do you think government should be doing to improve its approach to disaster relief?
I think they need to engage with local municipalities. The local municipalities at the moment are actually clueless, you know. They don't know what to do, where to go. Government as a whole, they need to begin to talk to among themselves about these issues, because the provincial government is not really speaking to local government about climate catastrophic.
I mean, fair point, but what's the point of engaging then if you suggest that local government is clueless? What's going to be achieved?
No, what needs to be achieved is that obviously local government needs to be allocated funds. So that they can improve on infrastructure, they can improve on personal staff, because that doesn't really exist in local government structures like municipalities.
Just a final question, and maybe bringing it down to a more micro level. You also suggest that the VAT increase, albeit incremental, is going to entrench energy poverty. Very quickly, explain to me how it's going to be harder for South Africans to transition to renewable energy as a result of this increase.
Yeah, I mean, currently at the moment, a lot of local communities basically cannot afford a simple 1 kilowatt, a basic solar system. So the 1% VAT increase will actually trap more people into energy poverty, even those that are actually willing to, to at least, purchase any solar technology. It will be very difficult for them, because with the VAT increase, the technology will become even more expensive. And that will, you know, that will actually make it very difficult for people to transition from the current system to a much more sustainable energy system that people would sort of be willing to jump into.
Thank you very much indeed for that perspective. That is Thabo Sibeko, who is Program Manager at Earth Life Africa, Johannesburg.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Small businesses in South Africa face constant hurdles, from cash flow struggles to digital exclusion and limited access to funding. Now, while the country's economic climate remains tough, entrepreneurs are finding innovative ways to survive and grow. One of the key debates is how technology and financial services can better serve SMEs, ensuring they don't just keep their doors open, but actually thrive. Matt Putman is the Chief Executive Officer of payment solutions company iCorca, and he joins me on the program now, post-budget 2025. And Matt, first of all, then, I think it's fair to say that cash flow remains one of the biggest obstacles for small business. What are the root causes, in your opinion? And right now, post this very difficult budget, what should business owners be doing differently to manage that process better?
Yes, Jeremy, are you correct? I think cash flow is one of the biggest challenges for small business. Like many of the problems in South Africa, I guess it's a multi-dimensional issue. Firstly, I think many small businesses, from some of the surveys and the work we've done with small business owners, we've seen kind of up to 63% of, especially the very small micro merchants, are not actually tracking their turnover on a daily or weekly basis. So they take payments for goods or they sell services, but they don't have a keen eye on how money is flowing in and out of their business. So I think that creates a challenge in itself. Secondly, there's probably two other main factors. The one is the time it takes merchants to get paid. So they will, you know, outlay capital to provide either goods or services to a customer, and then they inevitably have a delay to collect those funds. And that timing difference between when they've outlaid money and they've handed over goods or services to a customer and when they actually receive funds in their bank account is a key issue for them from a cash flow perspective. And then the third element is really access to working capital. A lot of these small businesses in SA don't have, you know, a traditional credit track record that banks understand, and therefore they have a lot of challenges accessing working capital to buy stock, to grow, to manage these kind of cash flow dips in their business.
So fundamentally, then, what do you think holds them back from accessing capital, and how can they improve their chances?
Well, I think, and I mean, it's quite a biased opinion, but it is based on data, is partnering with providers like Iqoqa, because I think we help digitize their business. We help bring them into the formal economy. And by just being able to, you know, see their raw turnover data through our platform, we're then able to help them access working capital. And as a result of that, you know, we've distributed north of 2 billion rands worth of funding into this SME sector, and close to 1 billion rand on an annual basis now. So I think using digital tools like Iqoqa that makes it very simple for them to formalize their business is a great way to be able to deal with this cash flow issue. And then secondly, we've also just launched a Iqoqa debit card where we basically pre-fund these businesses based on the payments they take from customers. They'll get paid same day, twice a day, 365 days a year, including public holidays and weekends, which is kind of an industry first in SA. So those things combined, I think, help SMEs, and we've seen quite good growth from our merchant base when they use these products. They're able to open more stores, buy more stock, etc.
It's inevitable, and you rightly point out, that we're moving towards a more digital economy, yet small businesses, many of them, are still cash-based. The difficulty, of course, is for entrepreneurs to make the digital transition without losing customers who still revere the notion of cash in the wallet.
Yes. I mean, I think that trend is changing. So, I mean, in South Africa now, we have, you know, a very high penetration of bank cards on the consumer side. Obviously, we even at a grant level, we have SASSA cards. So, you know, consumers have cards, but that utility of the cards, people not just going to an ATM, drawing out, you know, money on the first of the month and then using cash to transact. It's a pattern of behavior that's starting to change. And in some sectors, actually, merchants are losing business if they can't accept card payments from customers. But yeah, cash is still, as you point out, I guess, the predominant form of payments, but we are starting to eat into that quite nicely over time.
So we've taken a look at the digital transition, but also part of the problem is stock and inventory management. That can make or break a business, yet SMEs still struggle with this. What, in your opinion, is the cause behind this? And again, can it be addressed without expensive systems, which is often the case?
I mean, historically, the answer is no. I think you need both complex systems that create, you know, that have a certain level of computer literacy needed by business owners to run. And secondly, there have been quite expensive tools. I mean, we have just part of the Iqoqa Elevate event that we had last week, Wednesday, was, I guess, starting to roll out almost like a freemium inventory management, light inventory management functionality as part of the operating system of Iqoqa, so that it makes it very easy for small businesses to be able to, you know, track stock and inventory in a very simplistic way without incurring big costs.
Late payments from customers, Matt, also a big issue, whether it's an individual or even a larger business, and particularly an issue for SMEs. Are there practical steps, in your opinion, that business owners can take to protect themselves against this?
Yes, I mean, I think there's two sides to it. One of the merchants at the event we held last week pointed out that they offer discounts to their bigger customers for kind of, you know, early payments on invoices. And that helps create behavior where they're getting funds sooner. But through the tools that we've built, like, for example, we have an eCoreCare invoice tool where they can send an invoice with an embedded payment link to their customers to chase for payments. They can set reminders to remind their customers to pay them. They can send payment links via WhatsApp and email and SMS. So I guess having more ways of being able to collect funds from your customers, even if you're not seeing them physically, helps improve that that conversion ratio. But yeah, those two things, I think, both encouraging through incentive to your customers to pay early and then using tools like the tools that eCoreCare has built will help improve that collection against late payments.
So let me ask you this. SME failure rates in South Africa are high. In your experience, what separates the businesses then that succeed from those who don't?
Sure. I mean, it's a very tough question to answer, Jeremy. I mean, I think cash flow is the lifeblood of any business. So having access to working capital is super important. I think choosing the right sectors to build a business in upfront help a lot. And then, I think cash flow is, to be honest, probably the most important piece. Working capital, having strong fundamentals and how you actually manage your cash flow are probably the most important factors when we've looked at the data on what creates business failure versus success.
Matt Putman, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer at eCoreCare. And that is MoneyWeb at Midday for today. We're back tomorrow, live at noon, then up as a podcast. Goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.